When it comes to getting in shape, a lot of people don't realize that it's more than just about looking good. For some folks, fitness is a catalyst that profoundly transforms their lives for the better.
Today we're joined by yoga instructor John Mark Robbins, who grew up in ultra-conservative Texas, moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career as a Hollywood stuntman, became addicted to meth, and then turned to a daily yoga practice to help himself stay sober. This is his remarkable story.
Plus, why we need medical meth and cocaine.
Big boy yoga for the thick and juicy guys.
And why gay men are so attracted to meth. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Our guest today is instructor John Mark Robbins, who, take it from me, is probably one of the best yoga teachers I've ever had and the sexiest. We met John Mark in Austin, Texas, and are lucky enough to have him in the home studio for the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
John Mark, you just wrapped up a weekend workshop, Big Boy Yoga, teaching a yoga class to big guys, bears, thick and juicy fellas.
Absolutely.
Right? It was pretty good, right?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was like the best part of the weekend, I feel.
It was amazing seeing all these like bears. Like, there was so much love in the room and so much appreciation. And for a lot of these guys, it was the first time they had ever done anything fitness related in a group environment. So it was really like healing and empowering for them. And I want to applaud you and say how proud I am of you, but also like all those guys in the room too for doing this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, before you became the awesome, kind, sexy yoga guy that you are today, you struggled with some demons, from homophobia growing up in ultra-conservative Texas to an intense addiction to crystal meth while working as a stuntman in Hollywood.
Yeah. And keep going.
That sounds dangerous.
And there's more demons to come.
I mean, did you ever, like, when you were high working as a stuntman in Hollywood, you were like, okay, I'm going to catch you. 1, 2, 3, splat.
If I could ever, like, actually make it to a set, or it would have probably done that for sure.
Shit, man. So tell us about growing up in conservative Texas. As a kid, your family and you dragged you out of the house to protest abortion clinics when you were 6 years old.
Yes. Well, I grew up like that. Very active in the church. Very active in, you know, my father's a pastor at the
what
time.
What kind of church was that?
At the time, it was like a Southern Baptist church. And then over the
now
course,
they're Satanists?
Now or? They're Satanists. No, they're they're still on fire for sure.
So is that, what would like was that, is the flavor the name Southern Baptist? Is that the word to describe it and stuff?
Yeah, Baptist, Southern Baptist. They're
it's
not
the biggest not, church yeah, in the South. Okay, Southern sure. Baptist.
Yeah.
So. And so you guys like were very politically active, and you would go to abortion clinics and.
Yeah, my father and mother were very involved in the pro-life movement. You know, panda bears hanging on the shoulder, signs of fetuses, news cameras everywhere. It's kind of all these little mental images that I look back to.
When you saw like a picture of an aborted fetus as a 6 year old, what went through your mind? Or like, ew, or was it terrifying or scary?
Well, I mean, it was a big deal at the time. I mean, so. Mm-hmm. It is almost like the people across the street who were protesting against pro-choice or pro-life. See, I have it all confused, but we're like the yeah. monsters, you know, and what the actual life group was trying to bring out was this like, you know, really scary baby death fetus. I mean, like I was a child, so these are just what I'm trying to remember.
Did it give you any nightmares as a kid? Like, because I would imagine, like, when I see these kids protesting abortion clinics, I feel really sorry for them. You know?
Yeah, it's sad. I did. Those signs were really scary. They look like yeah. aliens. I mean. Really, that's what it looked like.
So. Would your parents, fetuses like, are coming scary. To get you.
Right, exactly.
Would your parents like allow you to watch scary movies, but wouldn't let you see scary movies, but they'd let you see aborted fetuses?
I could not watch The Simpsons.
Wow.
Growing up. Which I mean.
That's a paradox there, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like, this is more horrifying than this aborted fetus that's going to eat you, come back to life while you're sleeping and catch you.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And so you got a football scholarship. You were very athletic and in great shape in high school, and got into Ranger College.
Yeah, Ranger College, which was a very interesting situation out in the middle of West Texas, still kind of taking that like small town feel into a college setting. So really couldn't like come out there either, like, you know. Just had to like kind of.
But
go
all
the
you
flow.
College jocks are all having sex with each other, aren't you?
You know, I would go out of the city to have sex for sure. And you know, that was like Mannheim.
I thought you guys all did it in the locker rooms. No, you're ruining my sexual fantasies here, John.
Mr. Alabama, I don't remember his name, but he was like this 400-pound black dude, lineman dude, would always come up into my room and try to mess around with me.
Come on, baby.
He'd crush you.
Nobody
needs to know.
Yeah, he would have.
You'd just be on top. That's a solution. You know?
Like,
I've seen some of those football players, and they're enormous.
They are.
I mean, their thighs are just... I mean, they're on steroids, aren't they?
Well, this was like ex-prisoners. Okay. Like, this was like kind of the last chance for most college football. Like, if you weren't going to play, you aren't going to play anymore after this, after this school. And they got rid of the football program within a year of me being there, so...
So you lost your scholarship?
Yeah. It was like, yeah, it was done.
But it's not because you came out as gay or anything. It's just because they ran out of money.
Yeah, they ran out. Well, they just, you know, too much crime in one little area. Can you imagine? I mean.
Gobbled the whole city up. How did you come out as gay to your friends and family? At what year age was this?
Well, I've kind of come out like 3 or 4 different times. I came out when I was 13 in a church youth group setting. And the pastor was like, all right, we're, you know, gave this message about homosexuality and then asked if anybody, you know, struggled with that, and had everybody close their eyes, and then we all raised our hands if we did struggle with it.
if you masturbated to the thoughts of having sex with a guy.
Exactly.
And so you raised your hand.
I raised my hand.
But you had your eyes closed, so you don't know who else raised their hand.
Exactly. I kind of looked up, because I think that the youth pastor at the time had struggled with it, because he was like a hairdresser and or ex-hairdresser.
Yeah. All right, kids, which one of you are struggling with homosexuality? Oh, John Mark.
And so what happened there? Did he take you like to counseling or reparative therapy or anything?
Well, I told my parents, and I think my parents already knew. We had a pretty open relationship about it. I think that they were just kind of like in the like, this will pass kind of phase, you know, like we're not going to really worry about it and or think too much about it. You know, we're not going to like think like, oh, this is his life, you know.
So your parents never try to send you to one of those like troubled teen camps, which are basically like concentration camps where torture young people and stuff.
Not the first time. The second time
they did.
Well, yes, basically it was an Exodus program when I was 17. I kept having a lot of problems in high school, you know, and my dad and mother would talk, 'cause they were divorced. So they would talk, you know, about, you know, what to do with me. And, you know, and I don't know. I was conflicted. I don't know if it was right or wrong, you know. So I went, you know, and talked to this dude from Exodus, and who seemed more gay than me. So it really didn't work. I only went like 3-4 times, but.
'Cause you're a pretty butch kind of guy.
Yeah.
On the streets, not in the bedroom, but
introduced a bill into Illinois so that they can stop reparative therapy for anybody under the age of 18.
Oh wow!
So they can stop doing that. Well, so we'll see if that gets passed.
A lot of those concentration camps are actually illegal in most countries, but because Mormons actually make so much money, Mitt Romney's campaign financial manager. The financial manager for his campaign was one of these tycoons that owns a chain of these troubled teen camps, and they make tons of money kidnapping people's kids with the consent of the parents. The parents don't know what they're sending their kids to, really. And these, like, a lot of lesbians guys that get raped, tortured.
Well, they send them to foreign countries too, don't they?
Like Mexico, a lot of Mexico and Costa Rica actually have banned these institutions. Oh. They find them pests, and they're. If those countries, which have human rights problems of their own, don't want to imagine what is going on in theirs. But so...
So you did Exodus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And how'd that go? Did it convert you?
No, not at all. I remember that same year, I was in high school, during Christmas time, I hooked up with this dude at a hotel, like...
So what was like, was it a lot of praying? Was there any kind of like physical, you know... electroshock therapy or anything like that involved?
It was inside of a church. Okay. And it was like in a church office, very formal or well, maybe informal, but you know, I think that the guy just kind of had gone through the program and kind of like a sponsor, I guess. So maybe not so much the therapy side of it, but more like, hey, this is working for me, you know, quotation marks, but it's not working. You know what I mean? Kind of one
was
of those situations.
Was it a group setting or was it kind of one-on-one?
Well, so during this first session with him, it was just me and him for the first like two or three times. I can't remember if I did a fourth one or not, but, and then the second, you know, that was it. Like that was the end of the second coming, or the second coming out, mm-hmm. as I like to call it. But,
and so you auditioned for a commercial in Austin, Texas, and you got cast in it.
Yes.
What was the commercial for?
It was a gymnastics gym commercial. Okay. So I did some tumbling and cool stuff for the commercial, and was like, oh my gosh, I have to do this for my life.
How old were you at the time?
I was 19.
And so they were like, kid, you're going to be a star. Come to Hollywood and work with us.
Well, I watched Scream and got inspired by that movie because there's some cool stunts where like the girl flies out the window. And yeah. I was like, wait, so somebody has to do that for, you know, more, you know, there's got to be way more work like this. And so I was like, the only way I could do it is to go to Los Angeles.
Is that how most stuntmen get their start in Hollywood? Is it just, you know, they're athletes or people who have experience in gymnastics and they say, why not?
Yeah, it's a hard, hard, hard industry to get into. And it's mostly for disciplined artists or athletes, not like, mm-hmm. you know, oh, I played football in high school. It's more like I'm a yoga master. And that's the kind of personality they're looking for to do these stunts because you kind of have like, yeah, very like gymnasts are really good for stunt work, any karate disciplines.
Because the movement has to be very precise. Otherwise, people get injured, they die, they get hurt.
Absolutely.
And so you got attracted to this field and you were pretty good in it.
Yeah. I mean, like for somebody who was, you know, 19, 20 when I moved out there, yeah. you know, I got a lot of work for the short time I was out there.
So things seemed going really good for you.
Yeah.
And then you got involved with drugs.
Yeah.
Why did that enter into your life? How did that?
Well, looking back, I think like when I was 20, I was living in a big, huge city. Mm-hmm. You know, I had friends, but I didn't have like any family around. I was very lonely and very vulnerable. And the time that I was introduced to meth out there, it was like I was going to hook up with this guy who was a massage therapist or something like that. And we were like, he was just going to give me a massage and then mm-hmm. ended up like mm-hmm. he pulls out this pipe. And I'd never seen a pipe like that. I was like, and I was just like, I think I was just really open to experimentation, you know, and that was meth. It was like this weird sort of glassy meth pipe that had like this like ball configuration. And
I saw Breaking Bad.
I
mean, most people have seen what a meth pipe looks like, but what year are we talking here?
This was in 2006.
So why were you so, like, you hadn't been exposed to a lot of those anti-meth campaigns or anything?
Well,
like
I had actually, I did meth when I was 15 one time.
Okay.
But I didn't do it again. Like,
so of
that.
All the drugs that were available to you, why meth? Why was it this the drug that seemed to attract you? Despite knowing,
I mean, through from like
controversy.
From like 18 mm-hmm. to 20, I was very into like mild experimentation. I really didn't drink. I wasn't a drinker at all. I don't like alcohol. And I didn't like pot, but I loved like Ritalin and cocaine. And, you know, that was kind of like what we would do. And
you
liked
your uppers.
Like, yeah. I loved my uppers. And, but I
never drinking the yerba mate tea right now.
I love the yerba mate.
What is yerba mate for people who don't know what that is?
It's a bush. It's a tea bush. So,
from Argentina, right?
Or South America.
America. Traditionally drunken out of a gourd, you know, it's pretty awesome.
Which I think is still in the backseat of the car.
No, I grabbed it last night.
And, well, because our friend, Chef Jamie Lorita, happened to have a yerba mate kit.
Yes.
And he was like, I'm getting rid of it. He's like, oh, you drink yerba mate? Here, have it. Yeah. Thank you, Jamie.
That was awesome, Jamie. Thank you. Hit me up when you're in Austin.
And so, like, you know, you heard people, I mean, it's almost like a cliche. Move to Hollywood, get addicted to drugs, ruin your life.
Absolutely.
What in your mind, what's going on in your mind that says, you know, this is not going to happen to me?
It's like Because I think that's the perfect addict thing to tell yourself. Yeah. You know, it's like the same reason, you know, that you think you're invisible to like an STD or something like that. It's like, oh, it's not going to happen to me until it actually does. Yeah, I'm immune. Like this shit doesn't, you know, it's not going to. I'm privileged.
Did you have bad hangovers like the first times that you did used it or?
No, not really. I kind of liked the hangover a little bit.
So it was almost like drinking a cup of coffee.
It was like having a cup of coffee and then having like, you know, some time to chill.
So this guy, the first guy, did you continue to see him? And is that how you got hooked on it? Or was it other hookups too? And then all of a sudden you're in party situations. How did that develop?
Well, I had a little shame after doing it for sure, because I was like, oh, like I just kind of like did some awful things with this. I mean, basically just jacking off until my dick was raw for like, you know, 48 hours and ignoring, you know, text and stuff like that from my friends. So I thought that kind of made me feel a little shameful. However, you know, I think within like 3 or 4 weeks I was like over at his house again.
Because usually like when I read about addicts, this is what there's a lot of beautiful darkness in the way they describe the feelings of addiction. One addict wrote, when you do stop using the drug, using any medication, all you think about doing is how to get more money to score, even when you're in a recovery program. Even though you don't need to, you don't feel ill, you just want it. You want it bad. Life seems empty without it. There's nothing to replace it, nothing to look forward to. You look at yourself in the mirror and realize how skinny and ugly you look, and it seems like such a long road to put it all back together again. You say, screw it, and carry on with the drugs.
Oh, poor sweet baby angel.
I know. And so, like, for you, when you know, here's somebody who has a very formal, regimented training as an athlete. You know, you have to watch what you eat, your sleeping habits. You have to recover from your exercise. You're getting into a field that requires all this precision. And here you also invite this very chaotic element into your life that starts to taking over it.
Oh, yeah. And it didn't take long either.
So when, like, did you start showing up for, you know, because a lot of Richard Pryor Jr. was on the show telling us that, like, he was in his trailer and it was like, what drugs do you want?
Yeah.
Quaaludes, PCP. I mean, this is the 1970s and 80s, you know, so it's
like
Angel Dust. What retro sounding drugs can we bring up here?
Black Beauties.
I was working on Scrubs, the TV show Scrubs. And I think I was just like an extra or something like that. But it was a long shoot. Working on Scrubs was like highly desired after because you worked a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people on there. So like I was just like, hey, dude. Like on my Sidekick 2. Do you remember the Sidekick 2s?
It's like a smartphone.
Yeah, the first kind
precursor.
Of smart. Yeah, for deaf people. I was on the set of Scrubs on Craigslist trying to find drugs because I was like done. I was over it. You know what I mean? I wanted to use. This dude showed up. He had
onto
like,
the
he
set.
Was onto the set. He was
How
like
did
some
he get
executive
in?
Producer. I don't know if he was like of Scrubs or whatever, but he. Weagled his way in. We went to the men's restroom, like did a lot of meth, and then kind of tried to fool around in the bathroom a little bit.
Yeah.
And then we were like, "Fuck this, let's leave." And we went to the bathhouse, like right down the street in North Hollywood, the North Hollywood Spa. Was there for
and
just
he was
a couple
for
hours.
Too?
I don't think he was working for Scrubs. So he lived there, and okay. I think he was an executive producer. So he like just knew his way around sets. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He didn't care. He just kind of walked in with his drugs.
And typically, when you use meth, was it a way to kind of have the sex you wanted to have, or were you doing it without the sex?
Oh, I was only doing it with the sex that I wanted to have at that time, and actually, pretty much all the time, it was always kind of related back with sex for me.
Because there's almost like three types of drug users. There's the ones that do it to escape the psychological condition they find themselves in. There's the ones that do it to connect with somebody else, like for the sex. And then the third ones that do it just for their jobs. Like Sharon Needles talked about this on the show. Oh, where's my bell? And she actually talked about how she would lose herself in making costumes. She would smoke up a little bit and then just, you know, sew up a storm.
Do lots of meth just like Hitler and then start drawing swastikas just like Hitler.
I would never. The only thing I would probably do is like clean a little bit, but that would be like when I was coming down. But what I would use it for would be to like access this like super dark fantasy in my head, like super bondage, you know, all that sort of stuff is like, you know, kind of why I would do that. I could never really come to the fact that A, I was gay, mm-hmm. B, that I liked this really sort of raunchy sex, and C, that like, you know, this is the only way that it feels normal.
The drug gives you kind of permission to do what it is you mm-hmm. want to do, it seems like. And that's why I think a lot of gay men use it, is because, you know, we're taught that, you know, gay sex is bad, you shouldn't have it. So there's all these negative connotations around it. And so when you do something like meth, it gives you that euphoria and that state of mind. It's like, I can do this and I can enjoy it. And you can kind of take ownership of your sexuality in that way.
What was the best part about using meth?
Oh, man. I mean, because... You know, it's like praying almost. I mean, I really, because you, if you think about it, there's this like whole, like, I'm going to get online and look for this. I'm going to seek out this great thing. And once I find it, I'm going to go there and almost like worship it. It was very like.
So you were used to doing this in church. Oh, yeah. And so it's like, felt like second nature.
Yeah. Just a little darker.
Well, and because it's like, I feel like the gay angle or the sexual angle of meth was a theme that was kind of skipped over by the TV show Breaking Bad.
And yeah, you didn't see a gay character on there, really.
Well, you know, Gustavo was supposed to be gay, but, you know.
You didn't see them, you saw him dealing to like these, you know, people in the hotels and these grungy areas, but you didn't see them like, you know, dealing to at a circuit party or anything like that.
In 2005, 2006, like, meth was a big deal here in Chicago, and with a lot of like.
It still is, just FYI.
Well, it really made the news.
It made the news because you had high profile, wealthy, successful gay men succumbing to this drug, and with the height of Michael L. Jackson, who was a community leader, fundraising tycoon for the Hearts Foundation, he on a very intoxicated high got into a fight with a cab driver who was notorious for getting into fights with his customers, and got into his cab and ran over and killed him.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
And so suddenly the community here in town was like kind of having a, you know, like live and let live kind of attitude. And then suddenly it was like, oh no, we need to start a campaign to stop this. And so nationwide, you started seeing this campaign called Meth Equals Death. And it was a face of a man on the other side. Excuse me, almost burped up here. On the other side was a skull. And the spokesperson that they got to, and this is not a joke, was Lady Bunny.
She was the spokesperson?
One of the spokespersons.
Lady Bunny hates math.
Yes, and Lady Bunny would do these public stunts where she would have a pane of glass and a baseball bat, and she'd smash it.
I didn't realize that was her.
That was
Lady
Bunny.
Bunny really blames like meth for like the death of like the nightclub scene in the 90s in New York City. She's like, you know, the drugs changed and nightlife changed. You know, people used to do ecstasy, they'd do cocaine, they'd want to party, they'd want to be out and have fun, and then it was just kind of like people just like hole up in their apartments and do meth all night long and fuck their brains out.
I've never gone out in public when I've been using meth, like. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
Yeah, my feeling is like whenever I'm intoxicated or high on drugs, it's like the last thing I want to be dealing is with the unwashed masses.
Well, you feel vulnerable now.
You feel vulnerable. You feel like the police are out there. You know?
Right.
It's like if you're with your friends hanging out, you know, it's like smoking a joint, that's better. But it's like if you're out and people are pushy and picky and.
Yeah. You know? And well, and really, you just can't take your hand off your cock.
So your hands
long
are
enough to move.
You were telling me that you're like your hands were so covered in lube and you didn't even bother to wash your hands. That so you were like texting people with your lube covered hands on your phone.
Yes, actually,
we've all been there.
Come on, I'm not the only one, right?
Maybe. So you know, at what point in your in this situation you went? You were on the TV, on the movie Superbad.
Yes, Superbad.
And it went super bad for you.
Very, very bad. It was eye-opening. I showed up to work, and then I left and went and got high, and then stayed high until I had to be back at work. I did that, stayed up all night again at work, and then went and left and stayed up and I never shot up drugs, but I smoked a shit ton of meth. And then after that, I just kind of stayed where I was, didn't go back to work. And then I passed out for like 48 hours.
Wow.
So slept for like 30.
And so you lost your job.
Lost that gig.
Did you fall asleep on the set while you were supposed to catch somebody?
No. Unfortunately, I was at my house in my bedroom, safe and sound, but you know.
And was that the end of your Hollywood career?
That was it.
You moved back to Texas.
I've worked probably three or four times since then here in Texas. Or not here in Texas, but in Texas.
In Texas, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you moved back to Texas and you still were using, though.
Yes, I used, after 2 weeks of being sober when I moved back from California, I moved in with my father. 2 weeks after I had moved back, I escaped somehow, had some guy come pick me up at my parents' house. We went and used meth. And the next day, as he was dropping me off, my father had all my stuff packed up and the car. He actually met me away from the house. Like he
didn't want you inside the home.
He didn't want me to go near the home.
So he knew what you were up to.
He knew it was up.
How did he know you were doing? Did you?
Because it disappeared in the middle of the night. Took the credit card to get I guess I got a cab from them. Used my stepmom's credit card for a cab.
So they knew you were using.
Yeah.
Okay.
At that point, because it was actually only a 24-hour. Kind of stent, like I just kind of skipped work and.
Well, they must have seen this like muscular, handsome young man move to Los Angeles and then return this skinny
little 140-pound.
And they must have gasped and said, "What's going on?"
Yeah. Oh, I told. I actually had to write them a huge long letter, to get home. Like I was like, "Hey, this isn't going to work out for me anymore in Los Angeles. I'm like strung out on drugs. My life's a wreck."
And this is like a Christian's worst nightmare.
Like,
I have a gay son who's strung out on drugs and went to Hollywood and now he's coming home. Jesus.
My father's a prophet. And before I went out there, he was like, don't go out there. You're going to come back in a bag of like a trash bag, basically.
In a body bag.
Bag. Yeah.
And so they sent you. What did your parents send you? What happened?
So they
picked
me up.
Exodus, back to Exodus, because that worked so well.
Well, that was actually on the tables. Actually, I was either going to go to an Exodus year-long sexual healing place where you actually stayed there for a year. In
Waxahachie. It's not Marvin Gaye sexual healing. This is Christian fundamentalist sexual healing.
Right. No, for sure. It's like whatever. But it was either that or this rehab, but it was like for homeless people. So Christian Victory Ministries, that's what they call it.
I think that's what keeps me from, anytime that I find myself like pursuing unhealthy or risky or dangerous behavior, I just think of like Victoria Lamar and the friends and the people that she struggled with in recovery. And I go, I don't want to have to be in some, program with some people who are really, terrible shape.
Yeah.
And it's like, and that kind of like splashes cold water on me and gets me back. What was the experience of being like in this recovery program after you came out, after you told your parents everything would be fine, you went to LA and your parents are like, see, Satan, gays, we were right and you were wrong.
Right.
Well, so you still managed to keep your identity intact somehow.
Well, I stayed 4.5 months at this, rehab.
Were you allowed to masturbate there? Because I know sometimes recovery programs, they're like, no masturbation.
I did not masturbate until 3 months after I was there.
You didn't blow a load until 3 months?
I think after 6 weeks, I had my first wet dream, and then I had probably a second one. So, but it was a huge load when I shot it. It was beautiful.
How far did it fly?
It shot, there was like a 4x4 stall for a shower, and I just remember it definitely hitting my face.
Wow.
Straight up.
And so it was you and a bunch of other guys not masturbating.
Yes.
There must have been some hanky-panky, because you can't keep a bunch of guys together and have them not have sexual release. You didn't, there was no,
let's go to the bathroom. Nobody in that. This is homeless guys that I was in there with. I was not looking at
them
sexually.
There's some homeless guys that might be a crime.
Not this place.
No.
So, John Mark, was it hard to trust going into any recovery program because of the past abuse or, ineffectiveness of other types of programs your family put you in?
Well, to give some credit to this, because I do owe a little bit to them. It kept me sober for 4.5 months. There was something there, But it was, I definitely don't think that it was a, I don't think it was like a solution, a permanent solution. It was like jail. So
how long after you got out of there did you start using again?
It took about a month and a half for me to, and I actually, when I used again, it was like cocaine or something like that.
And was, again, the impetus sex?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because for a lot of meth addicts, like, cocaine is kind of like the organic version, like the healthy version of the same drug.
Yeah.
It's like, it comes from a plant.
Right.
Not from Drano. So how did yoga come into taking such an important part in your life at this point? It seems like all is lost. Everything's kind of out the window. Your identity is even up for question. Like, you know, your parents are like, see, you came out as gay and... this is what happened.
Well, being involved into something so physical my whole life, like, you know, athletics, sports, all that stuff. And also being involved in, you know, this sort of spirituality of Christianity and having and getting real impact out of it in some ways in my life. You know, I needed something that had movement, meditation and, you know, just overall wellness for myself and my mind, my body. And yoga was like, I didn't even know what the hell it was. I just knew that, like, I had to go to this class.
It sounded like a drug.
It did. I was like...
some exotic drug from India. Yoga.
Yoga.
Inject this, bro.
That's all I inject now.
You're freebasing yoga. When did, was it in recovery in these programs that you kind of rediscovered yoga? Or
I took a yoga class probably... 9 years ago and didn't really like it, but I rediscovered it more recently about 5 years ago, and that's when I really fell in love with it.
You're lucky to be in Austin because there's some great yoga teachers there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like you know, it's a city that really attracts a lot of healthy people and a lot of people who aren't to pursue careers in health and wellness.
Absolutely.
Like Lance Armstrong.
Yeah, well.
It's weird to go on that 24-hour fitness now.
It was.
There's no pictures of Lance Armstrong up anymore. Any of his sayings. There used to be everywhere.
Well, and shout out to my Bikram yoga teachers and Lisa Johnson, my Ashtangi teacher.
So was it these yoga classes you feel like were so critical in your recovery?
Yes. Well, I mean, in recovery, for sure... there's work that's done in that is more crucial than I think even the yoga aspect of it. But the yoga aspect of it, I feel, is like what sustains me in between, you know, which actually, you know, I'll go to some sort of meeting that'll be on one day and then I won't for, you know, 7 days or something like that. In between that, I'm using, you know, my yoga practice as my meeting, if that makes sense.
So. Yeah, it's interesting because when I always talk to athletes about what keeps you from like being self-destructive and stuff, and they say that it's almost like a game. It's the same reason like why Mark enjoys playing Words with Friends. It's this idea that like you want to keep your high score, you know, and if you feel like if you relapse, your high score goes back to zero.
Yes.
And so it's like the longer you stay sober, the more you're like, I want to keep that score high.
Well, you know. It's totally happened. I mean, like shaming and relapse, it's a real thing, you know.
And do you feel like sometimes like people, and I know I catch myself doing this with you sometimes, it's like we're like, you know, if you want to do some meth, I know where to find some. They kind of tease you into wanting to see you relapse because you're such a healthy, well-adjusted guy now that it seems almost like they want to see you struggle a little bit or fail a little bit.
Well, people in the program, I don't think do,
but outside
of the program, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like, I think it just depends. I know when you joke with me, it's like, it is funny, but I do think it takes me to a place where I have to become a little more stronger in that area. So some words don't just like take me to relapse. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, you want to do drugs? Let me think about that.
Well, let me just play that reel all the way through.
What would that be like? Well, we'd smoke, then we'd get naked.
We'd
like fuck for a little while. We'd fuck raw.
And then I would leave. And then
I'd go home and masturbate
else.
For a while.
I always say one of my biggest regrets in life is that I never got to get high with Whitney Houston and have sex with her.
Because you know she'd be fun to fuck when she's high.
Well, as long as she sings that song, you know, all of them.
I'm every woman, eat up my cunt. Rest in peace, Whitney Houston.
Love you, girl.
So when did you kind of want your final sobriety? Because the Christian recovery program didn't work.
No. I was dating a guy, and he was involved in a program, and I decided to attend this program with him, and it was really cool.
When was the last time you used when you started to attend the program?
At that point, I was kind of managing off of like doing it once a year, kind of, you know. But every time I do it, it would like interrupt my life for about 4 months. So
even if you just did it like for a week, the next 4 months was like you're paying for it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And in what way? How could the effects last so long?
Well, there's a lot of emotional and mental things that you have to deal with after that. I mean, because I feel like you're obviously not addressing what's inside of you that's making you, you know, want to go to that place anyways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'll have to undo all that, you know, and you probably lost your job or something like that during that time.
Okay. So it's like you didn't pay your bills.
You didn't pay the bills.
Those 4 days you got evicted for your apartment. Exactly. So then you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Lady Gaga said about the nature of addiction that once you're an addict, you're always an addict.
I agree.
And some people think it's not a good idea to talk about addiction as a disease because it turns people into a helpless situation and puts them in a passive state.
I don't agree with that. I think that it's okay to talk to it as a disease because, I mean, think about it. People who have, like, you know, HIV, for instance, they take medicine. There's a medicine for that. And it is a disease. I mean, like, I feel like just because I was born a certain way and have this reaction to a drug that, you know, other people don't have, that, you know, is unique in its own self. You know,
I wish there was a third word that we can use as opposed to saying everything is a disease, you know, because it's like some people with HIV, they describe it as like a life changing experience for them. And almost some people will say is like, and this is a very paradoxical statement. Becoming HIV positive saved my life.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you feel, I mean, it's like that resonates with you and your addiction?
Absolutely. I mean, like it, I don't think that I would be here in Chicago talking to you if I wasn't sober. If I was leading, I probably would be next door using crystal meth with your neighbor.
He's not cute. You wouldn't want to do
no,
that.
No, for sure. I mean, I'm just saying, like, that's where I would be if I was on drugs, but I probably wouldn't have been able to get a plane ticket up here. Do you know what I mean? So, like,
I always think that the most important thing that you can do when you're healing is to help other people heal as well. Mm-hmm. And one interesting thing in your career as a yoga teacher and practitioner is that you got involved with bears.
Yes.
And tell me, how did that come about? Like, what made you the idea to teach yoga to guys who seldom exercise, who have body issues, who are, you know, at really, you know, having a difficult time embracing their big size?
Right. Well, I mean, and for me,
may have a difficult time.
It fell into my lap. I mean, I could give you a story. I mean, I was a chubby chaser at one point in my life, for real. And then, you know, Dave McGill in Austin, Texas was like, hey, dude, I have some friends who, you know, who would love to have a yoga class done, taught for us who have bigger bodies. And, you know,
for people that aren't skinny white bitches.
Right. Exactly. No Lulu.
Well, because there was a blog entry about this woman who was like,
she was a skinny white girl who was like, she was in a yoga class and there was an African-American woman who was also in the class. And it appeared to the white woman as though the African-American woman was like really kind of struggling with the yoga and just kind of like didn't seem to kind of get it or was having a difficult time with it. And she was kind of like, oh, my heart goes out to her. And I was like, I felt like I should reach out to her, but she didn't. And she had all these kind of like, it almost seemed like this weird white guilt. And then she was also like talking about how like maybe the black lady was jealous of her skinny white girl body. And it was, people were just really kind of like, bitch, you are so full of yourself, you know. You don't know what that woman's going through, and maybe she was having a rough day, or maybe she's, you know, who knows?
It's a tricky situation because it's like you, like us, we want people to live the most healthy life that they can. We want to inspire people by example and encourage them. What kind of motivation do you give to these bears, to your posse, to your audience, to your tribe, to get them to be healthier?
Well, I mean, I'm a surprisingly, from all the darkness you've heard, I'm a pretty positive person in general. So I have a carry a pretty strong presence of being positive just in my everyday life. But in the classroom setting, you know, just offering a class that's modified for them where they are not thinking about like the person next to them, they're focusing on themselves is, you know, that's it.
Because it can be a struggle of like if you have a big guy or somebody who's overweight and then the rest of the class is doing stuff that's super advanced and they're getting into all these contorted poses. So you kind of want to, when you do yoga, in some ways you want to have people that are at the same kind of level of yours as yourself in the same kind of body position. Because there's stuff that I do, especially if you're in a class with a lot of women, they do a lot of stuff that I just like, I can't necessarily do just because like, you know, my shoulders are so wide.
Yeah.
You know, and they're doing stuff behind the back. I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah, well, so. And if you're a guy and you do develop pecs, for example, it's hard to do certain poses, right. You know,
and hips, like hip classes. I'm like, why are we doing this? I mean, I get it, but
I actually can do a lot of the hip stuff. But
well, it's because you have childbearing hips.
I do have childbearing hips.
Aww.
But it's like this is the number one question I get asked about everybody about fitness is how do I motivate my friend, my lover, my family members to exercise?
Man. I mean, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. And I think it's just, you know, motivation comes from like a little bit of, and this sounds weird, but popularity with like in the group. Like, you know, this is a popular class. You're going to come and you'll find motivation because all your friends are doing it. And then eventually that'll seek in like a seed and you'll want to do it internally.
I would say like the bear movement, and especially for gay men, and gay men are sometimes like so good at pioneering healthy new ways of thinking about chronic problems that we face. And I really like, I have deep respect and love for the bears that we know, because it's like, it's about loving and embracing your body the way it is right now.
Right.
And before, if you especially having struggles and problems with your body, the first thing you need to do is just like, you know, say, be at peace. And I tell this to a lot of people who are in addiction, who relapse. Sometimes they call us up and there was like, you know, I mean, Victoria Lamar did this a lot with us actually. And well, she's dead now, so I guess we can talk about all this stuff. But
she talked about her addiction on the show a lot.
So. She talked about it on the show a lot, so I feel comfortable bringing this up. But it's that I would say, listen, let yourself off the hook. Seriously. You're doing the best that you can.
Yeah.
And maybe the best you can wasn't good enough. But you know, tomorrow's a new day. You can do something different.
Yeah. In my yoga classes, I never talk about their weight. I think that that's also a why that it's so good for them. It's because it's like that's not what they're there for. They're there to feel good, to do something that's different for themselves, and to like become like yoga is like it's done in steps. It's like, all right, you do this thing and you hold and you become okay with this. This is your pose for today, and then you know next time you may advance a little bit and get a little bit better. And you know, it's not about like, oh my gosh, my belly is hanging over, you know, towards my knees. It's like, no, okay, that's happening. So today I'm going to step my foot back, and that's where I'm going to be today.
And that's the thing.
And I'm okay with that.
With yoga too, is like when you have a big belly, some of those poses are difficult to do. And it's just like even when I was like at my highest of like up to like to 260, and I take a yoga class, I was just like, oh God, I don't remember this one being this so hard. But as you lose the weight, though, those things get easier. But even still, today it's like some of those poses, I still have to kind of like pull my gut a little bit to be able to twist it around.
Absolutely. Well, we took it, the class with all the bears here in Chicago, and I would say like the beginning of the class did feel like going into a recovery meeting. Everybody says their name, what problems that they have with their bodies, and then their favorite dessert. And I thought that was a little unfair. I thought it made me hungry.
I know it made everybody hungry, but there was some cute answers. I like Bartholomew's, and he's just like, my name is Bartholomew and I have an injury. I have a limp wrist.
But my answer was the best one.
Oh, for the desserts. Yeah.
Because I was like, literally when people were around the circle, I started to think, what joke can I make?
Because they're all like ice cream. I said tiramisu. Somebody's like apple pie. And then Fausto said,
I said, my name is Fausto Fernos, and for dessert, I like a tall glass of cold water. And the whole crowd of bears went, oh.
They laughed.
They love it. No, they laughed. It's an icebreaker, you know, and it makes them commit to it. It's like, I don't really honestly have a favorite dessert. Mm-hmm. I love all sweets. But like, if I can come up with something that's like solid and concrete, I'm going to commit to it, you know. And if I can say, okay, this is my favorite dessert, then I'm connecting to the class already.
Remind me to dip my dick in sugar for you.
That ginger like candy sweet, was huh? so sweet.
You like it. Hey, before I forgot, I want to ask you, because you were on the Tyra Banks show twice.
Yes, twice.
Once you played a racist.
Yes.
And the other time you played a guy who was hot for a black girl. What was it? What's the story?
So the first time I played a racist, and it was like a round table discussion. Mm-hmm.
And they
just
said,
like,
you have to be a racist.
You have to be a racist, and you're from, you know, you can be from wherever you're from, but you just can't like all the four girls that we present to you that are all different colors.
Okay.
Second time, there was a girl on the show who I was getting engaged to, who she was a black girl.
Okay.
So it's not real. Reality TV, not real. Not
so
real.
None of that stuff was real.
None of that real.
And so do you have to go on the show and be like talking about, I love my black girlfriend.
Yes, totally.
And you didn't even know this girl?
No, I didn't know the girl from Adam. It's totally.
She might have been Adam.
I mean, she could have. Yeah, actually. She had a nice track weave.
Did you like, you know, because you do serve up like, you know, sexy hillbilly realness.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's like, I could totally, if I was a casting person, I need a prison
racist.
What is the name of that movie where that actor had
American
all
American X?
Yes, American History X.
I love that movie.
What's the name of the star of the movie? I'm like blanking out.
Edward Norton,
who totally juiced up and got ripped for it. You could totally play his like best racist friend. Be like, I'm gonna get those N words.
Well, because you're a ginger, and now it's like when I was growing up, redhead. It was always the ugly, beaten like a redheaded stepchild. Redheads were kind of on the out. Now
gingers are sexy.
They are sexy.
And finally,
when did you notice that sea change?
That's a newish thing. That's like within the last 6 years.
Yeah.
Thank God I got sober. You know.
Yeah, so you can enjoy it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
absolutely.
I noticed that in your publicity photos, you boost the orange hue in your hair.
Yes, of course.
Because in real life, you're kind of
white hair.
You're kind of like a blondish ginger.
Mm-hmm.
But in the photos,
your eyebrows are kind of white.
It's carrot.
It's strawberry blonde is what I am, technically. But, you know, I want to be a ginger because, you know, look at my, you know,
your beard is so cute.
My beard's very, and my bush is too.
And we take you out, like, we took you out to the clubs here in Chicago, and everybody was like, who's your sexy ginger friend? Is he a top or a bottom? And it's like...
And they're sending me their dick pics to send to you. Thanks, Johnny.
And there were not good dick pics, by the way.
Well, you had a pretty big dick. It was a good-sized dick. I don't know if I'd ride it, but...
Hi, Johnny.
He putting you on blast, honey.
He messaged me too.
Do you find yourself like attracted to other gingers as well? Or
I love they're like that's pretty much my favorite. I get
angry when I see couples like that though.
I've never dated one.
I've only had sex with them.
Well, it's like you hear black women say all the good black men are taken by white women, and it's like all the gingers taking all the other gingers. That's not fair.
you gotta spread that stuff around.
That's right. Share the wealth.
Yes.
So where are you going to go from all this? I mean, it just seems like you're a young guy. So much shit has happened in your life. Don't you just want to just go, thank God those days are behind me.
Well, I have a lot of plans. I mean, this is definitely my future is kind of being handed to me as it comes. But I feel like for me, it's like, I do what I can, and then I stop, and I kind of meditate and kind of see what comes next. Sometimes, like, I don't even know, what I'm doing this week, I don't know when I'm going back, It's like, I don't know. I just kind of have to wait and let things happen. Let it be.
You're working with bears, with big guys. It seems almost like a tide that's taking you in that direction.
Yes.
Where do you think that direction will be? I mean, are you going to be like Richard Simmons and going to morbidly obese gay men's homes and crying with them? Or I mean, it's like,
no, I love traveling, and I've written a little thing about things that I really want to do. And I think, this is a perfect opportunity for me to use to travel and to, Meet people. I love meeting new people.
Do you worry that people are going to discriminate against you? Because you're so open and honest about all these challenges and addictions that you've had in your past. And you know, a lot of people are very, like, terrified that anybody knows anything about that. And here you are, transparent.
Right.
About everything.
Haters gonna hate.
Our friend Michael McBride, another fitness guru, had his after coming on the podcast, he has his first official hater.
There's somebody on Facebook or Twitter that hates him.
And I'm like, I'm so jealous.
You have a hater.
I have lots of haters. I mean, I probably don't have as many haters as I have lovers after me, but I mean, I feel like
You always have to focus on the negative ones, because that's what's really important. Yeah. Is the negative. the positive ones. Come on.
But everybody has shit. You know what I mean? Everybody's got stuff they're working on, stuff they're working through. I'm not the only one who's been in a bathhouse with, you know, several dudes doing meth. You know, I'd rather use my story for the positive versus like.
Is it hard when you, I mean, because you're probably good at picking up when somebody's high.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I worked in an office and in a publishing company for 6 years where a good 2/3 of the staff was at one point or another high on meth.
And you had no idea. Office. You just thought they were weird.
Well, I just thought they were weird, or I thought they were drunk, or I thought they were acting strange or irrational. It never occurred, you know. Then later on, I kind of started putting two and two together after I had that job, and I was like realizing that they were on. And also, you know, talked to a couple of people that were like, baby, he was high all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, you know what's interesting, though, is like, you know, legally, like, marijuana is a Schedule I drug with no known medical value, but like cocaine and methamphetamine are both Schedule II drugs, and that they do have some medical value. And they actually say that meth is much more efficient at getting in the brain than something like Adderall or Ritalin. Wow. And if you're used in the right kind of doses. You know, back in the 60s, too, a lot of people were prescribed like methamphetamine for weight loss. And so you'd have all these housewives who were just jacked up, but they're like running around the house cleaning all high, you know, high on meth. And then other, you know, some doctors say that like it doesn't interfere with HIV meds, and so that's one of the reasons why people might do it instead of like drinking.
Right.
Do you think drugs should be legalized? Do you think meth and marijuana?
Sure. I mean, like, I feel like they could bring a lot. They have different I don't know, man. Meth is like a tricky one. I think that if you're going to use it, they need to really do some research on it. But I do think marijuana, of course, you know, why not some marijuana be legal?
Does making meth illegal help people not be addicted to it?
Well, I have a friend who's in jail right now. So
he's not using.
He's not using.
I hear that sometimes like people get in jail, they even have more access to drugs.
Yeah. Well,
not this case.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, I can't even see him. Like, yeah. The only way I could see him is if I Skyped into him. So, you know, it's like
you can Skype into jail.
You can Skype into jail. That's it.
Oh,
you
wow.
You can't even go into this prison or to this jail.
Well, because he's in isolation.
And you can't call him on the phone.
Can't call him on the phone.
Oh, wow. You can see him.
You can. I guess. I mean, you can see him from a computer, you know, yeah, or your phone. But
oh, cool.
I just want to also drive that, you know, yoga isn't for everybody. No, there's no substitute for a good rehab program. Don't do it on your own. Ask for help.
Yes.
This disclaimer. This worked for you, but everybody's road to wellness is unique. Absolutely. As their personalities are.
Yes. And don't go into a Bikram yoga class thinking that this is going to be my solution. No. You know, do a little research on it. You know, talk to people. Mm. Hit me up if you want. I mean,
because there's Crystal Meth Anonymous out there that's, you know, especially in the big cities, have some really strong programs. But I know in some of the smaller towns and, you know, and some people that like did drugs other than Crystal go to like AA meetings with the alcoholics because they feel as like they get more out of those kinds of meetings sometimes. So there's all sorts of stuff out there.
Do you think for the rest of your life you're going to be never use meth again?
I'm going to give you the most probably cliche answer to that. One day at a time, buddy.
One day at a time, sweet Jesus.
So, you know, and my feeling is like, if that day ever comes where you relapse again, don't be hard on yourself.
Oh, you know? Yeah. My community
is
pretty
strong. We'll masturbate for 48 hours.
I'll masturbate with you for 48 hours. Do you consider, going through this, do you consider yourself a Christian anymore?
a transcendent Christian.
So I feel that label still fits with you.
Yeah, I'm open to the goddesses though a little bit more now with the yogis, the yoga philosophy. So yeah, I feel like I'm a transcendent Christian.
So you went from Jesus
Christian.
To the elephant god.
Amen.
Ganesh
with the 8 hands.
I mean, I'm trying to be funny.
Long trunk.
And the big trunk, thick trunk. So, what's your relationship with your family now?
Oh, it's awesome.
Because they're still ultra-conservative Christians.
Well, they had like a... At the time that they were going through... when they were dealing with me, they were also having like a major transformation in their own lives. I mean, they went from like kind of the God that you can't drink, you can't do anything, to the God that is more like love-like, you know? And I'm not going
to
say
so
that
they
support
Shirley
every...
So they went from Shirley Phelps to that guy in Dallas that's on Oprah.
Houston.
Houston, what the hell's his name?
I forget.
Joel Osteen.
Osteen, yes.
But he's still kind of... I heard that
he's
Joel...
He's still anti-gay.
He's still
he
anti-gay.
Is. And my parents aren't anti-gay, but they're definitely not...
but you bring boyfriends home.
I can bring boyfriends home.
You can
home,
suck his cock in front of your mom. She's just like, oh, you boys.
That's not how you do it. Let me show you.
No, I mean, my mom's super awesome. She always like will let me and the person that I'm with know that where she stands on it, but that she loves us regardless.
Wow. What if someone wants to get started on a yoga program? What advice do you have for them?
Don't let your first experience be your last experience, uh-huh. because a lot of people, even myself included, I didn't do my second yoga class until like almost 4 or 5 years after the first experience that I had. Mm-hmm. So try all different kinds. There's a lot out there.
I want to do more yoga, but I feel like it gets in the way of the muscle bodybuilding and the weightlifting. And I'd probably be a healthier person if I did more yoga and less weightlifting, but I'm like... Gotta look good, bitch.
Yeah. Well, find some balance. You know, a yoga practice once a week is like, it's awesome.
That's what Saturdays and Sundays are for, fellas. Mm-hmm, yes. And I see some really hot guys at our gym taking those yoga classes now.
Yes.
And so you're starting to see this more in bodybuilding forums, is like bodybuilders are starting to appreciate and understand that the stretching allows the muscle to be more relaxed and limber. And so it actually looks bigger mm-hmm. when it's more fully stretched.
I agree.
Yeah. Work that shit out,
girl.
And it gives it more space to get bigger, like a balloon.
And this was another thing that I say to people is like, the best yoga you can do is the one you can do every day. And if it's 5 minutes a day, do it 5 minutes a day.
Yeah. And sometimes yoga is like not, it's just running around the it's going for a jog or something, doing something different, you know, philosophy. Yeah.
So you believe like yoga in everyday life, like brushing your teeth can be healing and meditative.
If you use coconut oil.
What is it you and brushing your teeth with coconut oil?
I am all about it. I don't do it all the time, but I have...
Your teeth do look good.
For a meth addict.
Yeah.
for a country
you
meth addict.
You have most of them.
Yeah. I use it because, A, I'm all about holistic and, you know, being kind of hippy-dippy-ish a little bit. And I love using coconut oil for everything because it's like, you know, it's proven that it removes the bacteria out of your mouth. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't like alcohol in my toothpaste, and a lot of toothpastes have alcohol. Mm-hmm. It also makes your cum taste really, really good.
The coconut oil or water?
The coconut oil and water.
Pineapple, water. Too.
Pineapple, too.
Put
yes.
a little coconut oil on your butt before somebody eats it out. It's always
you can
a nice
use
little
it
treat
for
them.
It's not
lube.
Like a
it's the
taste
best natural
sensation.
Lube, too.
We're big proponents of coconut oil.
John Mark Robbins, people can find out about Big Boy Yoga and whether you're coming to their town on Facebook.
Facebook is my yoga is actually Dog Yoga, DAWG Yoga.
And you have that tattooed inside
right
your mouth.
In my lip.
Yeah, like a prison tattoo.
It was a prison tattoo I got right before I moved to Los Angeles.
Wow.
Years ago.
That's hardcore.
Yes.
Before your life went...
I was such a gangster back in the day.
Wow.
I'm sure you were.
Yes.
Remember, people, that Feast of Fun is made possible by your financial support. 100% of your money does not go to buying drugs. It goes to keeping the website high... And smoking up a well-running site that keeps the show going. I'm trying to use like a drug metaphor.
I get it.
You get it, but get it's it. Not that funny.
And so the best way to support the show is to become a Plus member. If you haven't done that yet, do it at feastofun.com/plus. John Mark Robbins wants to give a shout out to
Rebecca in San Diego. She's also, I think, a Plus member as well. She's pretty hot.
So she'll be hearing this right now.
My friend Chase loves her.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for your support, girl.
We love you. Here's a little slide whistle for you.
Do a little shout out to David, who just signed up for a year membership. Thank you, David. People like you make the show happen.
Because of you, David, because of you, Rebecca, this podcast happened, and John Mark was able to tell his story. We're always looking for extraordinary people who live extraordinary lives. John Mark Robbins is certainly one of those people.
You guys are so sweet.
And I look forward to taking more yoga classes with you.
Yes.
Big boy and regular size boy.
Yes.
And you teach regularly in Austin, Texas?
Yes. Every Saturday is a big boy yoga class at 11 a.m. And then I have two other classes during the week, one for recovery people and then one for people who like to do the yoga that I like to do for myself.
And you may be coming back to Chicago for Memorial Day weekend for the
Pride.
The Bears might bring you back for their Bear Pride.
Yes.
Which
we're
is also
the
at the same
right
time
now.
As IML. Where it's very much of a crossover there. So.
Yes.
So you'll be stirring the honey pot.
Yes.
Guys, we also have t-shirts for sale, feastoffun.com/store, and we'd love to hear from you and your stories. You can post anonymously on our website, feastoffun.com, and share your adventures in babysitting your friends on drugs.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.